welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world around us. And today we're going to be talking a little bit about the French elections, more in the war in Afghanistan, and also Mamia Abu-Jamal's 63rd birthday and his ongoing struggle. But before we can move on, we actually wanted to start today's show off by wishing a very happy birthday to the voice of the voiceless Mamia Abu-Jamal. Mamia is almost certainly America's most famous political prisoner, having spent 30 years in prison after being framed for the murder of police officer Daniel Faulkner in Philadelphia in 1981. Nobel laureates like Desmond Tutu, Nelson Mandela, and Toni Morrison have all called for Mamia's release. The European and Japanese parliaments have made calls for the Mamia to have a new and fair trial. The NAACP also has called for a new fair trial, as has the city government of Paris and the Parisian suburb of Saint-Denis, named the road into Nelson Mandela Stadium after Mamia. Why have so many notable names raised serious issues about Mamia's imprisonment? Well, because it may be one of the most textbook cases of racism and anti-radical bias there is in a court case. A case that was so clearly and obviously political, it makes a mockery of the idea of justice. At the very least, almost all critical observers have seen that there should be a new trial. And really, pretty much all those who aren't afraid of being branded a friend of a cop killer have noted that at this stage, the miscarriage of justice has been so clear, Mamia should go free. So quickly, well, not that quickly, but, you know, as briefly as we can here in the time we have, what actually took place in Mamia's case? Well, first, it is worth knowing a bit about who Mamia is. Mamia was an activist since his teenage years. He was a leading member of Philadelphia's Black Panther Party, and later on a member of the controversial black organization MOVE that practiced a form of back-to-nature commune-style living with a deep relationship to traditional African principles and deep ecology. Mamia was also a very famous radio commentator in Philadelphia, known for highlighting the stories of the most oppressed people in a city that was literally run by hardcore, really fascistic-like racists under former police chief, then-turned-mayor Frank Rizzo, and was known for having one of the, if not the, most brutal police forces in the country. For that, Mamia was dubbed the voice of the voiceless and was widely respected among black journalists nationwide for his work. Like many who fight the good fight, he also was not rich, and Mamia drove a cab sometimes at night to make some extra cash. One night, Mamia came across Faulkner and another officer jamming up his brother. At the end of the altercation between them, Faulkner lay dead and Mamia was on the ground gravely wounded with a shot to the chest. Mamia was charged with murdering Faulkner, and this is where the story gets messy. Now, the prosecution presented a case with three main legs here: eyewitnesses, ballistics, and an alleged confession. As it concerns the eyewitnesses, here's what Amnesty International had to say. Quote, based on a comparison of their statements given to the police immediately after the shooting, their testimony during pretrial hearings, and their testimony at the trial, the key witnesses did substantively alter their descriptions of what they saw in ways that supported the prosecution's version of events. End quote. And no wonder, because one eyewitness was on probation and potentially in violation, something that had he been violated could have sent him back to prison for 30 years. So pretty easy to manipulate by the cops. And another was a prostitute who was both bullied, threatened, and ultimately given immunity to say whatever was necessary from the prosecution. As it concerns ballistics, it's also worth noting that the only real assertion by the prosecution is that Faulkner was killed with a .38 and that Mamia owned a .38. However, the prosecution's expert witness himself noted that it could have been any number of millions of guns in America. The police performed no gunshot residue test and failed to match any fingerprints to Mamia or, for that matter, Daniel Faulkner. And there's also the fact that Mamia was shot in the chest allegedly by Faulkner in some sort of shootout-type situation is how they were describing it. However, given the angle, there's really no way Faulkner could have shot Mamia where and how he was alleged to by the prosecution, which means that the whole entire story of how the shooting itself went down deeply in question. And finally, there's the issue of the bogus confession. Now, according to the prosecution, Mamia admitted to the murder defiantly in the hospital, except the report of the Philadelphia police officer who was with Mamia the entire time he was at the hospital but was never entered into evidence in the original trial stated that Mamia never said a word. And also one of the witnesses who claimed she heard it, well, turns out later she admitted to someone else that she'd lied. On top of all this, you have to examine the trial itself. It was provided over by Judge Albert Sabo, the so-called hanging judge. He literally held the record at the time for death sentences handed down and also had the highest number of death sentences reversed on appeal. The official court stenographer overheard him saying that he was going to, quote, help fry the N-word, end quote, referring to Mamiya. There's also the fact that not only does the analysis of the trial itself show the jury was picked to be racially biased, but recently we've learned that the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office actually was training all of its lawyers in how to pick a racist jury as part of their job. Ooh, literally, I've only actually given you a fraction of the information that points to this case being pretty dirty from the get-go. And since the original trial, huge amounts of documentary evidence has emerged that casts serious doubt on the prosecution's story. Really, quite frankly, totally eviscerates it. It's fairly clear what took place here, in my view, that a police officer was killed that night, and conveniently, the Philadelphia establishment saw it would be pretty easy to pin it on one of their most hated enemies. They tried. They hoped to kill him. They imprisoned him, but have not only failed to silence him, but ironically enough, have brought his voice and analysis on a range of issues of millions worldwide. And I have to just say here quickly, for my money, Mamiya's memoir of his time in the Black Panther Party is probably the best book written about the BPP. It's the most introspective and supple in its analysis, and really less of a memoir and more of an interpretive history with personal anecdotes. Either way, happy birthday, Mamiya. And as those of us who support him always like to say, free Mamiya and free all political prisoners. Well, yesterday was the much-anticipated French elections, and they ended with what is, quite frankly, a fairly remarkable upending of France's traditional major parties of the right and the left. The National Front's Marine Le Pen and Emmanuel Macron, who's a former socialist minister and investment banker, I just said socialist in air quotes there, and his new party, En Marche, have advanced to the second-round runoff that will take place on May 7th. Le Pen had been widely believed, really for about a year now, to be set to make it to the second round. Her stock had been rising as she capitalized on a right-wing populism that combined support for social welfare programs with a just clear and direct racist stance towards non-white people in France, immigrants and otherwise. Macron was a touch more surprising, having started this new political party. He also is, quite frankly, basically a right-winger posing as a centrist, operating on looking to gut France's traditional labor protections, ostensibly to revive the economy. And also, even though this has been flying under the radar, been well in line with the general anti-immigrant sentiment that appears to be pretty ubiquitous all across France right now. But he is very pro-European Union and thus tries to present himself as a face of tolerance vis-a-vis Le Pen, which isn't that difficult since the National Front started as a party of sympathizers of the Vichy regime, irredentist supporters of French colonialism, and outright Nazis. And while Le Pen has tried to broaden that image out, soften the edges a little bit, her niece Marion, who's also an elected official there with the National Front, seems to revel in some of these jackbooted thugs who often show up in the front rows of her rallies, throwing up those Nazi salutes. The other interesting element, too, though, was that Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who represented the far left, came in a very close fourth, dominated the 18-24 vote, and generally upended all expectations. It's also worth noting here that if you combine Mélenchon with other smaller parties of the radical left, the left-leaning Socialist Party candidate Benoît Hamon would have represented 27% of the electorate, more than either Macron or Le Pen, which, quite frankly, seems like an important point to make. Hamon and the Socialist Party, despite having almost his entire party abandoned him for Macron because he was viewed as too left-wing, was either too venal, too stubborn, or too desirous of being the left-wing tail to Macron's kite to find a way to combine with Mélenchon. The parties of the far left also were just practicing some sort of politics of purity, using every excuse in the book to not back Mélenchon due to what essentially is a dislike of the way he moved and set up his candidacy. But honestly, had all these parties all united, we almost certainly would be talking about a second round between a banker who hates social protections versus a radical former parliamentarian that wants to reorient France towards a renewable energy economy that focuses on workers' rights, not gutting them. Not to mention, it would have been a tremendous breakthrough for the left at a time where galloping right-wing populism is stalking the globe. So, hats off to Mélenchon for making a go of it. Hopefully, moving forward, France can still be a beacon of hope for those of us who appreciate humanity over those who seek to prostrate it purely to the needs of capital. And finally here, New Orleans last night begun the process of removing Confederate monuments from around the city, a pretty big development there. Four of the most prominent monuments to both Confederates and other sort of racist figures. Many people didn't think it could happen. Now it's happening. The first one they were taking down is, believe it or not, a monument to white people who tried to topple the city's first integrated government. They did succeed in taking it down. They did it late at night to try to avoid controversy, although that didn't happen. There was a vigil by these pro-Confederate people. Of course, all the media in the world was there. And when the cameras were turned on the workers, it turns out that because of death threats that had been sent to many of the workers who were taking them down, they were actually wearing flak jackets and helmets to guard against snipers. And police officers were stationed on rooftops all around in an anti-sniper operation, which is pretty remarkable that this history of just total racism and slavery is still seen positively enough by many that they might actually kill someone for trying to take down these monuments. Which is also a great time to mention that in a new Government Accountability Office report, it's noted that 73% of quote-unquote violent extremist incidents that have resulted in deaths since 9/11 have been committed by white supremacists. Those committed by those allegedly motivated by Islam represent 27%. Yet the attacks committed by, you know, those who were deemed Muslim extremists received 449% more coverage in the media. This country has a serious issue with racism and racist far-right extremism. However, it refuses to own up to it and instead has an entire political agenda shaped by the fake threat of terrorism from non-white people that totally ignores the role of U.S. foreign policy and even making this threat something people are talking about in the first place. And those are today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By any means necessary.
And since a lot did happen in the world, we are very happy to be joined, as we were off all last week, so thanks for our listeners for coming back here. We're happy to be joined by John Pfeffer, who's the author, who's a author and co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. John, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So France, I think a lot of us were on pins and needles. I didn't realize until the results came in how emotionally invested I had become in it. I want to get into a couple things, but maybe just some of your top line takeaways from yesterday's elections in France.
Well, obviously, the big news is that Le Pen didn't get as many votes as many people feared she would get. Remember, she was leading in the polls a year ago. It wasn't that they expected that she would get into the second round. They thought she would actually win the first round. And that would have been a huge shot in the arm to populists, right-wing populists throughout Europe. So that's number one. Number two, I mean, as you pointed out, you know, the left in general did much better than anybody expected it to. Now, of course, the left didn't come together in order to actually maximize its efforts. But, you know, that's parliamentary democracy. That's partly France. That's partly the European left at this point. And, you know, I think Macron is an interesting character. I mean, on the one hand, yeah, you know, he was an investment banker. His perspective, especially on economic issues, reflects that background. But he's also come out with some unusual statements. I mean, for instance, on a visit to Algeria, he condemned French colonial activities in that country as a war crime. I mean, believe me, that's not a position designed to make French conservatives happy, you know. So, and he stuck by that statement, which I really thought was quite unusual. So, you know, he likes to say that he's a true Gaullist, you know, that he'll take good policies, whether they're from the left, the right, or the center. And obviously, that's true. But with pressure, especially from a left that's resurgent in France, one could imagine that it'll take more from the left if the population presses him to do so.
So sticking with Le Pen for a minute, you know, one interesting thing I've seen people sort of ruminating on is whether or not Donald Trump had hobbled Le Pen because Geert Wilders didn't do as well as people thought in the Netherlands. Now Le Pen didn't do as well as people had thought. And that maybe now people have sort of seen at least a glimpse of this sort of type of politics and power, it maybe is giving them pause.
Oh, absolutely. There's definitely a Trump effect going on here. And not the kind of Trump effect that Trump initially thought he would get. Of course, Trump imagined that he would lead a kind of wellspring of anti-government, anti-EU, anti-international financial institution, globalization in other words, sentiment throughout Europe. And quite the contrary, I think people have taken a look at what's happening in the United States. First of all, recognizing that someone like Trump can come to power and that they're not just registering a protest vote, that this is an actual breathing candidate who could take over. Right. So they're having some second thoughts of that. But then taking a look at his actual policies. And remember, during the campaign, Le Pen was like, hey, you know, Trump changes his mind. He turns around, he bombs Syria. I, on the other hand, I'll never change my mind. I'm a crazy right-wing anti-immigrant racist, and you can trust that I will never deviate from that position. And that, I think, sent a strong message to waverers that this is not a woman who's going to become, quote-unquote, a professional when she takes office.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, it makes me wonder, I mean, is it possible for her to broaden her support and win? I mean, obviously she's not her father, but when he got into the second round, basically everyone united against him. It seems like that's kind of how it's lining up now. But I don't know. I saw an interesting article, and I think it was in The Guardian somewhere, that said that in a way, this is the matchup she most wanted because she can draw the clearest contrast and maybe she can win. But your thoughts?
You know, she'll do better than her father did back in 2002. I mean, he got maybe somewhere in the order of one-fifth of the votes. And my guess is Le Pen will probably get closer to maybe two-fifths of the votes. So a significant increase. There's still going to be a wide point spread, as much as 25% between, or 25 points between Macron and Le Pen. So yeah, she's already broadened it, and she's broadened it by jettisoning her father. She kicked him out of the party. She turned her back on basically Holocaust deniers. So she drew the line in the sand somewhere. She also is she's a woman. She's divorced. She's pro-choice. So all of these issues actually already expand.
Right.
And then I think the third element, aside from the kind of political, you know, distancing herself from the father, cultural, you know, she's a different kind of politician. There's also economic. She has gone directly to the source of the left's support throughout France by, you know, promoting a kind of anti-globalization, pro-social welfare position, which, you know, combined with her other positions, you could call, strictly speaking, fascism, because that's frankly what it resembles. But I do think that will expand her support, and there will be people, especially from Mélenchon's constituency, who will cross sides, just as there were constituencies here that supported Sanders and crossed all the way over to support Trump.
Yeah, I saw a Snap poll yesterday that 9% of Mélenchon voters are saying, just right now, before we've had any campaigning, that they'll vote for Le Pen, and 29% are saying that they will abstain. And the New York Times and a couple other places, I thought, had some great, you know, sort of on-the-ground commentary from folks talking about abstaining. So it seems like that was a kind of a big fear in the first round. People thought not that many people would vote. Tons of people voted. Could abstention end up being a huge issue in the second round?
I don't think so. I mean, it will be an issue, and we won't probably see 80% turnout as we did in the first round. But remember, the very prospect of Marine Le Pen becoming president, I think, will bring some people out who didn't even vote in the first round because they couldn't really decide. They weren't happy enough to vote for Macron. They didn't buy en masse. They didn't like the left. They certainly weren't going to vote for Fillon and the conservatives. But when they are faced with a stark, very stark, you know, choice between Le Pen and Macron, between someone who is basically beyond the pale of politics as we know it, and someone who is firmly in the center, if you will, of politics, even if his positions aren't necessarily centrist, I think they will come out and vote, and that will cancel out whatever kind of abstentions we might see otherwise.
No, I think you may be right. We are going to take a break there. We are going to be back with more after this break with John Pfeffer here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we're continuing our conversation here with John Pfeffer, who is the co-director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies, also an author. We're talking a little bit more about France, then we'll turn the page a little bit. But I wanted to turn to the left here because, you know, despite Mélenchon not making it into the second round, which I don't think many people were expecting at all, I mean, very interesting what he's done here. I mean, similar to Podemos, he's stopped using the left-right divide, sort of striking out even against his own political party that he started to form this kind of citizens-based movement. movement, which I think slightly sort of reoriented the left to some degree. And it seems like perhaps moving forward, the left in France, which, you know, I was feeling, say, last year, was in complete disarray, that Mélenchon has kind of created a new momentum and conversation, at least, to bring a lot of that sentiment together, which, as you know, is still very strong in France.
Well, I think you're absolutely correct. And, you know, the real measure as here in the United States and whether Bernie Sanders can have an impact on the Democratic Party is whether Mélenchon can have any impact on the Socialist Party. And the Socialist Party did very poorly in this election. It is, you know, dealing with the legacy of, you know, the decisions of François Hollande and previous socialist leaders, but it's also saddled with the association with the European Union and the EU in general. And that is something that the left in France and throughout Europe has to reckon with. The question really is for the left, is it a moment for engagement? In other words, to further democratize the EU, to push it in a more economically equitable direction? Or are we going to abandon it as the left and in some sense join in a kind of almost left-right coalition against what's perceived as an increasingly rightward, technocratic, drifting European Union? My preference, of course, is to engage with the EU, to transform it, because there's a lot there that is still very positive. But the left has to make that decision in France and throughout Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems that the German and the potential Italian elections will probably have a lot to do with what happens there. I mean, I remember I read an interesting story that I had missed at the time. The day the Brexit thing was handed in, the European Commission was actually meeting and talking about they had to do more of a social Europe type of piece and that they maybe had gone too far. So obviously they're being affected by this and perhaps, you know, a good showing by the left in France. I think obviously whatever their contradictions, the SPD in Germany, who I think will has a good chance to win, and who knows what's going to happen in Italy there. But I think all the parties in Italy relatively critical of the, you know, austerity type push that perhaps the sort of EU of 2 years ago that I think has, you know, sort of set off some of this sentiment might not be the EU of next year.
That's absolutely correct. And so the decision about the EU is in some sense also a decision about what the left and what left party means. What does it mean to be socialist in Europe today? Of course, we don't have that question so much here in the United States, unfortunately, but that is a live question in Europe. And it's hard to predict, you know, the degree to which this right-wing populism sharpens the mind, you know, of socialists when they see what, you know, the alternative can be. And one would hope that the quote-unquote globalists, the one who not only support, you know, integration, but also support kind of the larger economic globalization model, that they'll step back and say, hey, you know, we are actually digging our own graves unless we support a fundamentally different economic model. It's not we're going to like get rid of banks, but we have to have regulatory framework. We have to have national framework that can put a limit on the kinds of fast money, the kinds of extraordinary wealth creation for less than 1% of the population, and the immiseration of large pockets of people throughout Europe. Unless they come to that realization, they will find themselves not so much out of office, their representatives won't be voted in, but they'll find themselves also up against the wall very, very literally by popular movements who are outraged at economic inequality in throughout the Europe.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, I was once talking to someone from the PTB in Belgium, and they said in the factories their biggest opponent was the fascists, not the social democrats, because of that reality. So I want to touch on the UK real quick before we leave Europe. Snap elections here, Theresa May has called these snap elections. I think this was widely expected by many people. It seems as if she's going to sort of romp here. Any feeling in your mind that perhaps Jeremy Corbyn can sort of pull something out of the hat?
Look, if we're talking about the disarray of the left in France, I mean, they look like one homogenous, powerful force compared to Labour in the UK. Honestly, I think Jeremy Corbyn made a mistake in not coming out more strongly for the EU and the Brexit vote. I mean, regardless of what he may think philosophically about the EU, strategically, it was a bad move because if it had been rejected, Labour could have claimed victory. They could have staked out a position along the political spectrum that was distinct from the Conservatives. And now there's an end run around them by the Liberal Democrats who can put themselves forward as much more EU friendly. And no one really knows what Labour stands for any longer. And as much as I might like Jeremy Corbyn as a peace activist and as a movement person, as a party leader, unfortunately, he's made some strategic miscues.
Yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, I think Jeremy Corbyn, great guy as a person. I see him in PMQs, and sometimes he gets some good points, and I like what he does. But it does seem that they weren't really ready to win, and they didn't know what they wanted to do, him and John McDonnell on that team, and now who knows? So, I mean, you know, I'm fingers crossed, but, you know, we shall see. So I wanted to turn to Afghanistan here, where, I mean, it's sort of quite a bit going on. I mean, but primarily, it seems like the U.S. is sort of laying the groundwork for a big or potential significantly, I don't want to say big, but significantly larger escalation of the involvement there.
Yeah, well, no one expected that in a Trump administration, we would see escalation in these conventional wars. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was no question that Trump was a militarist. Right. He supported increasing the military budget. He's perfectly happy with drones. He wanted to bomb the S out of Islamic State. But these traditional places where, for instance, Trump said the Iraq war was a mistake and we don't want to lose our troops, we didn't expect that he would take these more conventional positions. Mm-hmm. Those were the positions we expected Hillary Clinton to take if she had won. Unfortunately, for whatever reason, we can go into those reasons, but I think Trump has decided that, you know, first of all, he has delegated authority to his military people because he has admitted that he knows nothing mm-hmm. about these issues. And so the military folks are like, well, we missed our opportunity, right. You know, under the Obama administration. We have been given free rein, you know, so let's do it. Let's see what we can accomplish in this period of time. There'll be some pushback. I mean, there'll be pushback, obviously, from Congress. There'll be pushback within Afghanistan itself. Maybe there'll be significant enough pushback to actually nip this in the bud. Mm-hmm. I'm sure on your show, plenty of people have pointed out that public opinion polls demonstrate the American people do not want to see a continuation of, at this point, the longest war the United States has ever been in mm-hmm. its history. They do not want to see an escalation. They don't want to see body bags. They don't want to see anything, frankly, except, well, withdrawal of U.S. troops and the smallest contingent of maybe advisors there, that's what they'll tolerate.
No. Yeah, I mean, it just seems that the whole strategy of escalation has very little leg to stand on with this 140 Afghan soldiers killed in this base by the Taliban. The Taliban stronger than they've ever been, I mean, since they've lost control of the government. I mean, it just seems like there's absolutely no evidence that this could work.
Well, I mean, we all knew that the Taliban was going to get stronger. I mean, mm-hmm. these are the projections early on in the Obama administration. Mm. And I think the Obama administration's notion of a surge in Afghanistan was predicated on the idea of pushing the Taliban back enough to guarantee some form of negotiated settlement. Yeah. Well, that didn't come because, of course, the Obama administration actually didn't move very far on the diplomatic front. And instead, you know, as American troop levels declined over the years, the Taliban took over more territory. They could take advantage of all sorts of campaigns against U.S. occupation mm-hmm. or corruption in Kabul. And so they've gained strength that way. And now we're stuck in a position where, frankly, negotiations are always possible, but we're going to be in a weaker position.
Right.
And military solution, like it was before, is not right. available. So, you know, the best, to be honest, the best we can hope for out of this situation is that Trump will wash his hands of the situation mm. and say, look, this is not something worth focusing on because I can't get a big win. And
right.
of course, what Trump wants is a big win. Afghanistan is not the place for any country, any president to get a big win.
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, it just seems like there's really no way you're going to have real negotiations if you won't normalize the Taliban at this point. It seems like they control way far too much territory. And whatever people think about the Taliban, it looks like if you're trying to end a war, you know, all the players who are the real players, you know, from Iran to China to the Central Asian republics, all got to get at the table. But there doesn't seem to be anybody who, and I think the United States, many people would see them as the country to do this. The Pakistan-India piece as well being in there to sort of bring all these people to the table doesn't seem like that's going to happen. And ironically, it seems like Obama was just never very interested in it.
Yeah, I don't know why. I went down to Doha to participate in a conference on Afghanistan, and there were Taliban at the table. And it was a fascinating conversation because, you know, if it were just the folks in the room, and we were, you know, academics
sure.
and policy people, if we're just the folks in the room, we could have hammered out a negotiated settlement. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that difficult. I mean, the political space between Taliban on the one hand and, say, you know, the most conservative mm-hmm. American representative, it was actually not very large. why the Obama administration decided not to do that, I mean, partly it could be a function of their recognition that any kind of negotiations with Afghanistan were going to, number one, stimulate enormous resistance mm-hmm. by conservatives in Congress. And number two, it would be difficult. It would just be difficult. Whereas with Iran, well, there you had something that was very concrete. Mm. You had some intermediaries who were interested in doing so. And it actually could mean important economic benefits from U.S. corporations having deals with Iran. What kind of economic benefits are you going to have with Afghanistan? It's one of the poorest countries in the world.
That's right.
It's true. China has made some important investments, extracting stuff from Afghanistan, but that's not how the U.S. was looking at the situation. So I think that explains to a certain degree why Obama didn't invest into that agreement. And the third thing, of course, is that there was no significant constituency in the United States saying, hey, we want peace with Afghanistan. If you look at with Cuba, for instance, significant change in Cuban-American community, as well as within the Republican Party, as key people in the Republican Party saw dollar signs when they were looking at Cuba. All of that contributed to the calculus by which Obama made the decision, Cuba, yes, Iran, yes, Afghanistan, no, North Korea, no.
Very interesting. The last one, I still think, huge missed opportunity. But nevertheless, I'm glad you brought up Iran. I hadn't even had this on my list of things to bring up, but also, interesting presidential election shaping up there. I mean, I had sort of felt since Trump was coming more bellicose, you know, Iran might shift a little more bellicose, but Rouhani, he's in there. It looks like he's going to win. And I think the bigger news, Ahmadinejad, they refused to allow him to run, which was interesting because he was getting some, you know, quote unquote, liberal support from some people who liked that he was critiquing some of the conservatives and maybe striking a middle ground. So it seems as if the drift in Iran, and I think probably the Iranian people generally are in this way, is still to try to find room for engagement as opposed to confrontation.
I think so. I mean, there are still a couple of conservatives in the race, even though Ahmadinejad was kicked out. And he wasn't kicked out, I think, for ideological reasons. Mm. He was kicked out because he's a corrupt figure who's under investigation. And that's just an embarrassment. And they didn't want him to run in the first place because he's an embarrassment.
Right. I believe the Supreme Leader advised him, don't do this.
That's correct. And Rouhani, you know, he's in a difficult position. He can point to some significant economic improvements for the country as a whole. Partly that's a function of the reduction of sanctions, not the elimination, but the reduction of sanctions. So oil and gas interests, Iranian exports, they've gone up a tick. So he can point to some statistical improvements. Mm-hmm. Problem is that your average Iranian doesn't feel necessarily that the economy has improved for them in their pocketbook. And so the opposition to Rouhani can say, look, you know, you negotiated this deal with the great Satan and they didn't get rid of all the sanctions. And we're still, you know, dealing with this major crippling effect on our economy. And, you know, Rouhani and Zarif, his foreign minister, you know, they can counsel patience, you know, they can say this takes time. That isn't necessarily, you know, a great political platform, but I do think it will be a sufficient political platform to guarantee a second term. And remember, virtually, I think it's possible every president has managed to get a second term in Iran. So it would be going against, you know, an enormous precedent if he were to lose in the second term.
Well, you know, my question is, where are the people in Congress who supported the Iran deal? I mean, it seems as if all the people who, you know, I mean, I thought they were tepidly supporting it anyway. I mean, they barely, you know, the Democrats at least barely even supported their own president. But now all these people who are like, oh, I'm making this stand on the Iran deal, don't really seem to be anywhere to be found now that the issue is cropping up under the Trump administration.
Or worse. I mean, they, in some cases, they're supporting additional sanctions against Iran. On the other hand, remember, we have Boeing has negotiated two separate deals with Iranian airlines. Mm-hmm. These are huge deals. They're going to mean huge number of, to use Trump's expression, huge number of jobs here in the United States. Oh, and by the way, Boeing contributed $1 million to Trump's inauguration committee. So Boeing is definitely is pushing for the Iran deal. There are enough conservatives even who recognize the economic potential of engagement with Iran. That has meant that so far Trump has not ripped up the Iran agreement. He's not gone and said we have to renegotiate immediately. He has said he still thinks it's a lousy deal. He still thinks that it should have been done better. But to date, it's still in place. And even the U.S. government recently, I think it was last week, it declared that Iran was compliant with the deal. And so it's going to be hard argument to make here in Congress. If Iran is compliant, if there's huge number of American jobs on the line, how can you rip up this agreement?
Mm-hmm. Steve Mnuchin came out today and announced some new sanctions on Syria. I mean, it really just sort of seemed like one of those just kind of doing something to say that you're doing it at this stage in the game. I mean, I think whatever people think about what's going on there, and, you know, we talk about that a lot on this show, it seems like the Trump administration, they came in with one idea. They were sort of boxed out, I think, of doing anything with Russia. Let me put you like this. It was set up in a way where they didn't want to take the political hit to try to make it all about ISIS. And now they seem to have no second plan and are just kind of flailing around as it concerns Syria.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Trump sent his 59 Tomahawk missiles into Syria. And the statement was not so much to the Syrian government, although obviously the Syrian government recognized it as a message to them, but it was more a message to Americans here. Mm. And the message was, and if Trump could have written this on the missile itself, he would have done so. And that message is, I am not Obama.
Mm.
You know, this is an administration which does not waffle. It does not draw red lines that it then ignores. This is an administration that resolutely acts. Now, he didn't say this is an administration that resolutely acts and has a plan for a second act. No. I mean, Trump rarely thinks through the consequences of his actions, much less come up with a kind of coordinated response that would take us down the road. So it did what it had to do. It was a message to the U.S. people. Of course, it was a message to Xi Jinping. It was a message to Kim Jong-un in North Korea. It was this kind of general message of, I am resolute. I am not Obama. Beyond that, we have no serious strategy. Of course, we have no serious strategy. We have not figured out, the Trump administration hasn't figured out exactly how it wants to deal with Russia, if it wants to have kind of broad-based cooperation or not, hasn't figured out how it wants to deal with Iran and Saudi Arabia, Iran on the one hand with the nuclear deal, Saudi Arabia on the other hand with the war in Yemen, which the Saudis want us to support with greater resources.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly haven't figured out how to balance an approach to Assad on the one hand and ISIS on the other. Again, this is a multiplayer game. This is a multiplayer game when Trump maybe has mastered tic-tac-toe.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, I think is, you know, stretching his capabilities.
I think it's clear that there's a lot of unbelievable missteps here, but we're going to have to leave it there today. That's John Pfeffer. You can check out a lot of great work of his and others at Foreign Policy in Focus, which is at the House at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's also an author. Please check out all of his books. Thank you all for listening to this two segments, but we're going out. We have one more about Mamia Abu-Jamal on his birthday and his case here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, with your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about the ongoing case of political prisoner Mamia Abu-Jamal, who, as we mentioned at the top of the show, his birthday is today. And I think a little bit more about political prisoners overall in the United States. And we are very happy to be joined for this conversation by Netfa Freeman, who is from Voices with Vision, which is a radio show at WPFW 89.3 FM here in D.C., as well as the organization Pan-African Community Action, and Noelle Hanrahan, who's the director of Prison Radio and who co-wrote and produced the documentary Mamia, Long Distance Revolutionary, which I highly recommend. Thank you both for joining the show.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Eugene.
Well, I wanted to start here with you, Noelle, is that as we noted at the top of the show, our show today, and you didn't actually hear that, but we noted that it was Mamia's birthday, said a little about his case, and we mentioned that he had a court hearing today as well. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about what was at issue in that court hearing and where does Mamia's case stand?
So the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Ronald Castile, who was a judge on the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, when he was overseeing the appeals of death row inmates and people in Pennsylvania prisons, that he had to recuse himself. that he could not sit on appeals where he was the original prosecutor or he was involved in decision-making. So that was a U.S. Supreme Court decision in a Williams case. And it directly affects, it is directly on point in terms of Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. So Mumia was in court, in the Common Pleas Court of Pennsylvania and Philadelphia today, arguing that he deserves to have his case reviewed, his criminal conviction, because the person who sat on all of his appeals was also an ADA during his original trial and was the district attorney of record all during his appeals.
Wow.
Then became a judge.
the rabbit hole is so deep here. Netfa, you know, here we are on Mumia's birthday. You carry his commentaries, I believe, every week or close to it on your radio show, Voices with Vision. So here on Mumia Abu-Jamal's birthday, I was hoping you could also talk about why that's so important for you and the work you do.
Well, one, I have to thank Noel and Prison Radio, because without Prison Radio, we could not have the commentaries that Mumia has, because they're produced by Prison Radio. And so thank you, Noel, and everyone that's involved in Prison Radio. I think one of the starkest points is that Mumia has actually broken a ceiling that a lot of people don't realize. In terms of Mumia was a journalist that was not only a radio journalist, but he also a literary journalist. So he wrote also and was very radical and cutting edge. There's so many people that are following that footsteps right now. I'd like to think of myself as one as well, who writes and gets published in other places and also has a radio show. And then now with the proliferation and the possibility of radio, and then even you yourself, I think that you have to say that we can attribute that to Mumia. And the fact that we have been able to keep journalism honest in this world of corporate media, corporate news media, and so much profit motive involved in how it shapes the news. Now we're able to see that when Mumia was doing it at a time when it was just hard. It was, you know, it was kind of maybe a little harder to be so honest in the what we many people call the mainstream media. And so I think right now, Mumia also sets an example of someone who's incarcerated, who's very selfless about his cause, always raises up the causes of other political prisoners, and raises up truth, speaks truth to honesty, truth to power, in spite of his circumstances. Because a lot of people could be in a situation and just, you know, neglect the hard issues because not wanting it to affect the likelihood of them being released. But Mumia doesn't do that.
Well, and Noel, with Prison Radio, and you guys have been able to get so many of these commentaries out to so many people around the world. I mean, one of the things that it's just, it was interesting to me to reflect on this morning that I think is an extreme irony is that, you know, at least from my perspective, obviously they've been trying to silence and bury the voice of Mumia Abu-Jamal, but the very injustice of the case in and of itself, and I think the uprising of people, I mean, I remember the Millions for Mumia, that was one of the first political events I was ever aware of in my life, actually, on a progressive level, that in fact, his voice is now heard by millions and millions and millions of people. So almost the exact opposite effect of what I think the state was hoping to accomplish by trying to railroad Mr. Abu-Jamal here.
You know, I think that Mumia is a reporter. He happens to be trapped in this prison, and he's been reporting from inside really consistently for now 37 years. So he was on the outside as a young person and really an incredible journalist, like top of the line, really valued and employed by National Public Radio, National Black Network. When I sent him this list of radio stations, I said, well, who did you work for? He wrote down every single station he worked for. It was like 15 stations. So I think he has the ability to really communicate well. And Prison Radio's gift to all of us, I think, is just that we've been able to amplify his voice from inside. We've been able to make sure that he wasn't continued to be buried, that his work continued to succeed in at least getting over the barriers of the prison walls, and to all of our benefit and to my benefit, because I get to hear it all the time as well. But I think Mumia, in his, you know, he's every man. He's treated like every black man in America. I mean, he's no different than everyone. And then also he is this extraordinary journalist as well, who just keeps on maintaining his ability to speak truth to power inside or out.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a great point, too, because, you know, being on the inside and having a great journalist in there is also a unique view into mm-hmm. so many of those prison issues. I mean, that's when I first started connecting with solitary confinement, for instance, is hearing Mamiya talk about it. I think recently, and correct me if I'm wrong here, Noel, but I'm curious about your thoughts on this, too. The hepatitis C struggle, I think, revealed that, you know, there's, you know, tens of thousands of prisoners in Pennsylvania and around the country whose health care is so terrible. I mean, it really, in and of itself, that piece alone is sort of a unique thing. I mean, it's sort of rare you have a talented, trained journalist in a position to get that day in, day out oppression in prisons out as well.
I think that Mumia is able to just transfer that level of like commonality. Like, he speaks so warmly and so humanely about other people inside prison. You know, there's so much going on inside prison. It's a whole world. You know, 3.5 million people are in there, and one in 46 will do time. But he's able to give respect and agency to that experience. Like, I think the best reporters talk to the people who are affected. Now, that's not what happens in our culture. Mm. Our culture wants to hear talking heads, and they want to have, you know, like, prison coverage is ubiquitous, but it's not really telling the stories of people inside. It's some caricature of prisons, right? Mm. It's not what really happens. It's not primarily focusing on what real people are going through. So I think Mumia does that. He is the anecdote to the nonsense out there, and he's like a compass for truth. Mm. So I appreciate the fact that he does that with us and for us, and that he allows us to talk to people that would be our brothers, our sisters, our cousins, our mothers, you know, all of the people that we know that are caught up in the system. He brings their humanity to life through his reporting.
Mm, absolutely. I agree 100%. And, you know, Netfa, I'm curious here because at the outset of the show, I mentioned that this case has been going on for about 30 years now, so for some time. So, you know, actually, a couple generations have been able to connect with this case. And I think that's, on the one hand, terrible because it's still an issue. But on the other hand, the fact that it hasn't died, I think it's a testament to who Mamiya is. But I'm curious, since we're here on his birthday, if you could reflect for us, how did you first come across Mamiya's case? I mean, what was it that, when did you first sort of see it, and how did it strike you? Don't say you don't know, because I know you probably do.
I'll say the first book that I read, well, I've only read two books, I'll be honest, by Mumia, but the first one was years ago, Live from Death Row. Mm. And that was a long time ago. I mean, you're making me think about how old I am. But, I grew up in Philadelphia, but Mumia's case didn't happen until, it happened like a couple, when he got arrested. It was a couple years I'd already moved to, I was about to move. I moved here in 84.
To Washington, D.C.
So it was a couple years that it happened, but then I wasn't political then. So it wasn't really like it was going to be on my radar. And so, it was years after that I can't remember the time that I bought Live from Death Row and read it. It had to be in the early 90s. Mm. And paying attention to Mumia, and also hearing, and I guess, you know, when I probably came, when I really started paying attention to what was happening with MOVE, because Mumia was the only person talking about MOVE. Mm.
And that was the MOVE bombing, the anniversary of that this year, where the city government of Philadelphia dropped a bomb that destroyed a whole city block on the MOVE headquarters. But go ahead now.
Right. But I had already known about MOVE because I grew up in Philadelphia. Mm. And in fact, on Osage Avenue, they dropped a bomb, but I didn't know the truth about MOVE, because I was growing up under the propaganda of the media and the state. And so it wasn't until like you mentioned, the bomb, I had already moved up here, and then was paying attention to, oh wow, they did that to that, you know, those people. But it was only hearing about, you know, getting the truth from voices like Mumia that was like, wow, who is this person, you know, shedding this light, and then hearing about his case, and I was like, wow, okay. And so that's the first time I can probably remember about it. And then it wasn't long after that I was Live in Death Row. But also I wanted to mention, because Mumia has written also so many books as well.
Yes.
And then one of them was, I can't remember the exact title. Noel might be able to, Jailhouse Lawyer. That was one of the later books. What's the exact title, Noel? Do you remember?
Yeah, Jailhouse Lawyers.
That's it? Just mm-hmm. Jailhouse Lawyer. Yep. And so that one, and like, well, everything that Noel also talked about before, and even Live from Death Row does it, humanizes people who are incarcerated and talks about them so much. So often people can get these notions, these stereotypes about people in prison and be scared of prisoners and be scared of prison and whatnot. Not that it's a nice place that you want to be going to, and there's nothing to be careful about if you go to prison, but still, Mumia has a way also to bring out the brilliance that's not just in prisons, but even in our communities, in our neighborhoods, in the hardened neighborhoods, and then how people, how our humanity is really arrested. And it's the system that does that to us, and not just people are just born criminals or anything like that. And so I think that's one of the gifts that Mumia does, and about everyone and everything, and such a broad, just an incredible base of knowledge. And often I wonder how he gets informed, how he stays informed about certain things, enough to be actually have some cutting edge analysis on things that some of us who are outside of prison with all the stuff, more things available to us, can have some of the most backwards perceptions about things that are going on in the world.
That's deep. Well, you know, Noel, since Nefa brought it up too, I don't want to bury the lead on this, because you brought up the MOVE bombing, obviously the anniversary of that, I believe, I don't know what it is, 30th or whatever it may be this year. But I believe, and I hope you could enlighten our listeners, there are still political prisoners outside, not just Mumia, affiliated with the MOVE organization that are still also fighting for their freedom. Is that correct?
That's correct. And Mumia just last night did a piece on Phil Africa, and it just got posted to our website. But he's doing a series to humanize the MOVE people who are in prison. So there were 9 MOVE members sentenced to 30 to 100 years for a 1978 confrontation, and there are 7 of them. 2 have passed away, 7 are still inside, and he's been profiling them. And we've been recording them and mixing the scenes together. So we have Mike Africa talking, as well as Mumia doing wraparounds. We have Eddie Africa. We have Janine Africa, and we're working on getting the others. So he thought it was really important that people had a better understanding of who they are. And so he's been doing these profiles of them, and last night's was Phil Africa's. And I just want to say it's incredible to visit Osage Avenue and NAFTA. I can't believe you grew up there. I mean, if you go back there now, have you, it's just, I went back there, right, a few days ago, and it is really intense, because the bombing happened over 30 years ago, and they wiped out 62 houses, and then they rebuilt a number of them, but the houses were rebuilt in substandard ways, and so that 36 of the houses were abandoned, and 15 people stayed, but there's some like 50 houses that are in disrepair, and many of them abandoned. So it's a small street that's lined with abandoned houses, and it really felt eerie being there. It is like a urban testimony to how you can destroy a community and how you can destroy a neighborhood and try and wipe off by killing 11 men, women, and children. Like, it's a site of one of the worst massacres in U.S. history, where they dropped C4 explosives on this family wiped out six, and they said let the fire burn, and wiped out 62 houses. So it's just chilling to go there. Because a lot of kids in Philadelphia today don't know about it. Like, I was in a class at City College every Thursday night, and none of the people who grew up in Philly are taught this information, are given the information. So that's why it's so important to have programs like NAFTA's, because people aren't going to get the information from the establishment that they like really need.
And like Eugene's program.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Neff. I appreciate that. Prisonradio.org, by the way, is the prison radio website where you can hear all those commentaries, and hopefully you can donate a little money right now. I know they're raising some money. But Neff, I'm curious if you wanted to comment on that as all, as a Philadelphia. I've known you for over a decade. I never knew you grew up in Philly.
Oh, yeah, I grew up in Philly. I grew up on 53rd in Osage, so I was like 10 blocks away from where the bombing was on 63rd. Wow. And I know the area very well. It was my stomping ground as a young person. And actually, when hearing Noel say that, just brought it's very emotional for me right now. I haven't been in that part of Philadelphia for a long time, and I would have assumed that they would have done something with those houses by now. I know that I remember the substandard housing, and them not really giving any real redress or correction for the people that they destroyed the housing.
Sure. No, I mean, I'm just sort of curious. I mean, it's an interesting piece. I mean, coming up as someone not being politically aware, I mean, how does like an event, I mean, sort of what was maybe even like the propaganda like around a bombing like that? I mean, because they must have had some sort of story or something.
Well, I already left by the time I was here, in like a year after, they did it a year after I came here. Mm. But even growing up in the 70s when they were in Powhatan Village and around the Drexel University right. area, that all the propaganda was around MOVE was, and, you know, Mumia, I wish I had known about Mumia, you know, around then, but was around, oh, they breed rats and they were dirty and they, you know, all kind of crazy stuff that as a child, you know, you don't have any filter to be able to know not to believe some of that mm-hmm. stuff. And my school bus used to ride right by them. I used to actually see it, this place that they had. But they moved from there because of what happened, like Noel talked about. They attacked that in, like, I think it was like 78. Mm. And then they moved, and I hadn't heard anything from about where they were or anything. I didn't even know they were right down the street there from me.
You know, MOVE was really on the forefront. Like, they were wearing dreads before Bobby McFerrin. You know, they were it was Bob Marley and them. And then they were talking about ecology. You know, they were composting.
Yeah.
They were talking about things that, you know, the society had not yet, the light bulb hadn't gone off, right? Mm-hmm. So they were far ahead of their times. They were talking about animal rights in a very assertive way. Their first demonstration was at the Puppy Palace, which was like a dog mill. Mm. You know, so they have this integrated philosophy about life, you know, really. And they were not willing to tolerate any colonialism boot on their neck.
Mm.
They were uncompromising in their vision of what they saw. They were not going along to get along. If they saw something that was destroying the fabric of the culture and life, they were going to say it.
Yeah.
And so that put them at direct odds with people like Frank Rizzo, people that wanted to play this game that MOVE was not playing. So I respect their ability to like keep the truth really present and their courage in keeping on saying it. And then I also know that, you know, we have to have resistance. You know, you can't expect this culture to evolve to the human place that it needs to be without taking stands and without saying what's wrong and without being witness to this stuff. And certainly MOVE an amazing example, frankly, of being witness, even though they were before their time and they were made an example of. I think they are truly have a lot of integrity.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point, and we are going to leave it there for today's show. I think that's such a great note to end on. Another happy birthday to Mumia Abu-Jamal, locked behind bars there. Free Mumia. We are going to close today's show on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to everyone for listening. I'm your host, Eugene Pergier. See you next time.
By any means necessary.